Chapter 28. Tilly. I felt better for having auditioned, if you can call it that. Better, not because doing so provided me with any sense of accomplishment, or because it abated my anger at having to prove again what I had hoped was already abundantly clear. It did neither of these things. Rather, I felt better simply because there was nothing else to be done. I left the sheaf of questions and answers, sealed in their manila envelope, at the offices of Brightleaf Studio. I did not return them to Blair, as I had been instructed. Leaning against the smooth stone counter, I scribbled the title of the film and my name across the front of the envelope, and I placed it in the hands of Erica, the receptionist, a full-lipped, blue-eyed wonder who was guarding a lobby of nervous hopefuls like a nurse at an asylum. The hopefuls fidgeted along the wall in green and gold chairs, torturing scrolls of paper and muttering with vacant eyes into the air, as though in deep conversation with spirits.
No direct submissions,
the receptionist cautioned perfunctorily as I handed her the envelope. She pinched it between her fingers like it had been soaking in urine. It was highly irregular for me to have gone about things in that way, straight in through the front doors, as though I had no agent and no name, as though I was fresh off the bus and ready to transition from hayseed furniture store commercials and a modeling gig or two into a stroll up the red carpet in one smooth step. As though I had not already been in the business. As though I had never been nominated at Sundance nor graced the cover of the entertainment tabloids. As though I had not, at one time, already had the very part for which I was auditioning. She translated my cursive scribbles upside down and looked at me in surprise.
"Oh,"
she said, turning the envelope around and flicking her blue wonders up at me, suddenly, to confirm the name with a face. She swallowed, leaving only a residue of her former expression and, in its place, a look of uncomfortable apology. She gestured hesitantly with the envelope toward the offices on the other side of the wall behind her.
"Mr. Gaines isn't in. He's over at—"
"I don't need to see Mr. Gaines," I said. "Send it wherever it needs to go." And then I left. Her stare at my back and the asylum patients still muttering, but with recognition in their eyes. Pushing my way through the heavy glass doors and stepping back out into tinseled sunlight, splashing brilliantly off the broken white rock that lined the pathway to the parking lot. I put down the top and donned my shades. I drove off along Wilshire, the morning sun full in my face, feeling better about things. Better simply because there was nothing else to be done. A door closed in my head, and for the first time in a very long while, I was able to put the Lion Tree behind me. After a quick lunch, I kept an appointment with Milton Chenoweth. Milton was pushing 75, but he was still a big man with solid shoulders, a full head of silver-white hair, and a face that would have been jowly at the jaws and wrinkled at the eyes, but for the retained services of the man with a scalpel
that he referred to only as the wizard. When I entered Milton's office and plopped myself down into one of his blue overstuffed swivels, he rose to his full height, gave me that Ed McMahon laugh of his, gestured to the chair in which I was already seated, and told me that I looked fresh. Fresh, meaning young and energetic and full of optimism. It was a standard, overused greeting for Milton, a distilled variation of freshly famous, which was a phrase Milton liked to say he picked up from John Wayne in the glory days when he and the Duke were signing movie deals like they were autographs. Freshly famous was the Duke's polished up euphemism for freshly fucked, which was meant to conflate dizzily euphoric post-coital expressions with the distinctly orgasmic look of young starlets who are beginning to feel those first surges of celebrity pumping through their veins. The walls in Milton's office were lined with the slickly framed autographed likenesses of his clients, the resume of a talent agent. The faces were arranged in no particular order, but if one were so inclined, they could have been aligned to arc neatly through all the eras of modern American film, showing that Milton Chenoweth had indeed been a very heavy hitter 20 to 30 years before my visit, and increasingly average as the points of light in the once dark, clear skies above Hollywood began to bleed into one another, losing their brilliance and growing indistinct with the fuzzy glows of minor talents. None of the photographs were as large or as prominently displayed directly above the desk as that of John Wayne. If the wizard was the guardian of Milton's future, the Duke was the guardian of Milton's past. One of the only occasions I can recall Milton losing his trademark avuncular demeanor, becoming instantly, though briefly, peevish, was when I asked whether the Duke's mother had ever stopped calling him Marion, his given name. But I got the impression that for Milton, that afternoon, fresh did not mean freshly famous or freshly fucked. It meant simply fresh, new, keenly attuned to burgeoning possibilities. I suppose that is what he meant because that, at long last, was how I felt.
"You've put that mess behind you then?"
he asked, loosening his tie and reclaiming his chair. "I'm ready to move on, Milton."
"Sure you don't want to audition?"
he asked. "I'm sure."
"You've heard how he's doing this. The written audition."
"Oh, I've heard," I said.
"Pure nonsense. Have you seen them?"
"Seen what?"
"The questions."
"No," I lied inexplicably.
"Damnedest thing you've ever seen. Essay questions. College stuff. Blair's lost his mind. Everybody's talking about him. Never seen him loosen his grip on a project like this before. Just handed over the keys. And handed them over to Angus Mann, of all people. The guy's a drunk. He's a has-been hack writer who doesn't know the damn thing about the movie business. And now he's running the whole goddamn show."
"He's not a drunk or a hack, Milton. Maybe a has-been.
He doesn't make movies, Tilly. Okay? He doesn't make movies. I still think you ought to sue the bastards. You've got a name and reputation to protect in this town.
I looked at him without responding, as though genuinely considering the issue. There were only a few people like Milton Chenoweth still around who could refer to Greater Los Angeles, or even Hollywood, as a town without any hint of irony.
You can't just let them push you around. What's the word from Conrad?
I'm past it, I said dismissively.
Conrad's good, Tilly. I've used him twice, personally. He's a barracuda in an Armani suit, that guy. He could get you a judgment. He could at least scare a decent settlement out of Brightleaf. They've paid out claims on this mess already. I'm sorry I ever steered the project your way.
I don't want their money, Milton. Let's move on to something else. Your message said you've got something new. Milton leaned back, dropping his large, fleshy hands in his lap, and twisted a silver ring on his finger.
You move on to something else one way or the other, doll. That's easy. There's always something else. That doesn't mean you have to let go of your rights.
I'm letting go.
You're sure?
I'm here.
Okay, you're the star. Well, then.
Milton swiveled in his chair and shuffled through some papers on the heavy oak credenza that held down the floor beneath the Duke. He extracted a file folder and dropped it on the desk.
Moving on. Simon finally got through to Alan Yates over at Columbia. Alan's got something that Simon thinks will be perfect for you.
What do you think, Milton? Simon's nice, but...
a little young?
Green.
Simon's going places, Tilly. Wait and see. Chenoweth, Taylor, and Reed will be here forever, but I won't be here forever. Simon's good. His father's in the business. He's well connected in this town, very well connected. He'll take good care of you. He is taking good care of you, Tilly. I back him 100%.
Milton leaned in toward me, bracing his forearms against the edge of the desk.
Trust me.
I trust you, I said.
You know, I was about Simon's age when I first met John.
He jerked a thumb over his shoulder.
I ever tell you about Kate Hepburn and the horses when John was working on Rooster Cogburn?
Yes, at least twice. And I think if she were here to defend herself, she would smack you silly, Milton.
Oh, Dolly, you got that right. Whew. But it's the absolute truth, according to John. Stunk something awful, he said.
Okay. No stories about the Duke. Let's have it.
Right.
Milton slapped the file folder with his hand.
Price Point, it's called. Raymond Lang and... what's the guy? Abrams. Cecil Abrams are putting it together. Action suspense. Terrorism thriller. Loaded with names, Tilly. You'll be in very good company. Unlike certain never-to-be-mentioned-again art house literary pictures stocked with mediocre talent, this is a big-budget blockbuster, Tilly. Loaded with A-list names.
And who am I?
Wife of an ex-CIA spook. beautiful neurosurgeon with a rising practice. Husband was bounced out of the agency because he didn't follow rules or some such thing. I don't know all the details. He's working as head of security for a corporation with a lot of foreign mining interests. Turns out, the company he is protecting is playing footsies with a nest of terrorist... what do you call them? Cells. Terrorist cells. The company wants some highly sought-after mineral extraction permits, and the terrorists want to get onto the payroll of the company's foreign subsidiary. Why, you ask?
I do? I asked.
Yes.
Okay. Why?
Because that gets them critical access to a fleet of corporate jets.
Ah. I nodded slowly. If Milton picked up on my skepticism, he didn't show it.
See, the company believes the target is a Middle Eastern government, I forget the country, which is just fine with the company, since that government has steadfastly banned all outside mining interests.
I raised a hand to slow him down. So, the company uses the terrorists to...
But it turns out, Tilly, it turns out that the real objective of the terrorists is a simultaneous strike on 15 different government and military installations in the U.S.
I see.
Now, don't give me the face, doll, just listen. Now, the husband, ex-CIA guy, Jack is his name.
Isn't it always?
Patience, Tilly, hear me out. Jack finds out about the plot and has to fight not only the infiltrating terrorists, but also the greedy corporation and also the CIA, who has long since washed their hands of Jack and doesn't believe anything he says and has its own reasons for letting the terrorists take out another Middle Eastern government.
Am I in this movie at all?
I'm getting to that. You. Wait, what's your name? What's your name?
Milton leafed through the file with a tremor that was getting difficult for him to disguise. His finger came down decisively on the desk.
Sienna. Jack and Sienna Price.
Price Point, I said.
You got it. Sienna is lecturing at a medical conference in Bahrain. Smart role, Tilly. Smart role. And she gets abducted by members of this terrorist cell who've decided that they need some insurance against Jack the husband, who's too close for comfort.
Milton stopped contentedly, as though there were nothing more to say. And? I asked.
And, well, you need to read the script for the details. Simon says there is a pretty gritty scene where you have to use your skills as a surgeon to save a limo driver who gets caught in a crossfire.
Boy, gotta love that. I made no effort to hide my insincerity.
Okay, I know. I know, but she's resourceful. You can make her real. In the penultimate scene, you're strapped to one of the seats in the plane that's headed for Washington. It's a heroic role. More of a co-equal lead, really, than a supporting role.
Do I have to fly the plane?
Don't know. Read the script. I know there's a parachute scene, so maybe not.
Sex?
Strongly implied. Maybe audible. Nothing visual.
Nudity?
They're thinking brief and from the side. Could change. You've shown more.
I was silent for a moment, contemplating the floor. Terrorism, huh?
A movie for our times,
he said.
Hardly Katie Finn, is it?
Look, doll, Katie Finn was a great role. Katie Finn launched you. Peppermint Grove was a great vehicle to get you nominated, but it didn't get you the little gold man.
And Price Point will?
Probably not. But you never know. Point is, you've got to keep moving. Don't become one of those independent art house robots. Variety, Tilly. Like the magazine, Variety. Every few years, go ahead and sign up for the latest Jane Austen rehash, but don't make that your bread and butter. There will be another Peppermint Grove. I promise there will. Okay? I promise. But wait for the right one, kiddo, and in the meantime, keep broadening your appeal as an actor who can do it all. You need a romantic comedy under your belt, too. You've never had a blockbuster action role. And Simon's right on this one, Tilly. Price Point is a great place to get your foot in the door.
All I could do was sigh. It was not like I had anything else competing for my attention, and Milton Chenoweth was lacking neither persuasive ability nor timing. He leaned across the desk and handed me a sheet of notepaper.
Here, take a look at the starting lineup.
Zach West? I asked, impressed.
The golden boy himself.
Holding on to that bit of information, were you?
I know how to lay it out, doll,
he said mischievously.
He'll be a huge draw. Huge! This thing really can't lose.
I kept reading. It was an impressive roster of who's who. They're all on board?
Most of them. Although, you know how that goes. Most of them are a sure bet, I think. Cecil Abrams doesn't fool around or pinch his pennies. And on board or not, I'll tell you this, kiddo. They all want a piece of it, and they're not all wrong. And their agents aren't wrong about this. You don't want to be left out of this one.
They want me for the role?
You're not alone in the field, but you're on the list. Lots of your contemporaries would like a crack at Dr. Sienna Price.
And Zach.
Yes, they all want time with the golden boy.
You know his real name is Zell? I asked. Zell something?
Whippo,
he said.
Zell Whippo. Hey, wouldn't you?
What kind of name is that?
Don't know, don't care. Neither should you. Zach's about as big as they get right now. This thing can't lose, Tilly. Let Simon set it up.
Who am I up against?
They're not talking, but I'm sure you can guess.
Milton winked at me.
No one you can't beat.
I looked around at the faces staring back at me from the walls. You mean no one that you and Simon represent? He let out his Ed McMahon chortle and leaned back in his high leather chair, exuding his implacable charm. The Duke looked down with that wry sideways smile.
You're a pistol, Tilly,
he said.
You're a tough cookie, all right. But I don't see the world that way. Whose idea do you think it was to get Jimmy Stewart to do the shootist? Think I represented Jimmy Stewart? Of course not. But I knew it would be good for John, so I made it happen. Don't you worry about who I represent. I'm in your corner. What do you say we give this one a shot?
We looked at each other for a moment, me at him, and he and the jowly Marion Morrison back at me, until I finally broke under the weight of his gathering smile. Okay, I said. Okay, I'll read the script and let you know.
Absolutely. Make sure it feels good.
He gave me another wink.
And if it doesn't feel good, come on back here so I can talk at you until it does feel good.
I left my agent and the Duke and went home. I did not entirely know my own feelings, which seemed alien and agitated in my thoughts. I pretended to read the newspaper. I scoured my sink. I blended fruit. I called my mother and fully regretted it before she answered, incapable of patience enough to endure my father's latest insensitivity. I ended the call too abruptly, which only made me feel guilty, or at least more guilty, for there was already a layer of remorse in my heart before I had even dialed the number. I could not explain it, but it was there, like a shadow or a smell. I scoured the sink again. Milton had been right. I was fresh. I was optimistic and on fire with my own future. I was burning, consigned to a brightening pyre that could be seen from farther and farther away with every passing year. The promise of forward movement after so much waiting was exhilarating. But for all of its affirming helium-like qualities, it was an ephemeral, hollow sort of joy that filled me, and whenever I allowed myself to become still and quiet in my life, I felt stalked by desolation. The sun was high and bright in the sky, and there was still time for a run. I changed clothes and headed off to Griffith Park, the top down and my hair whipping. Price Point lay in the seat next to me, flapping in the breeze and chattering about itself. Griffith Park was one of the few places in Los Angeles that never quite felt to me like it was of Los Angeles. It is an urban oasis of sorts, lacking the inauthentic airs and graces of its environs. An oasis, but never quite the manufactured, manicured movie set oasis of the kind scattered throughout the city, the kind made mostly for tourists, and the exported image that made Los Angeles as much a product as a location. Griffith Park was different. Never mind that the venerated Hollywood sign, that quintessential American emblem that Angus Mann always said, with a hint of tragedy, defined America more in the end than the Constitution or Statue of Liberty, is stuck into the forested hills of Griffith Park like a cheesy, "My name is," convention sticker. Never mind that the park has itself starred in countless films, from Birth of a Nation to Rebel Without a Cause. Never mind the LA Zoo and the Greek Theater and the tourists. And as with so many actors, never mind the scandal and the inglorious headlines, for even if accurate, they do not reach the depth of truth. Griffith Park was different. I ran my usual route, a combination of paved and dirt trails that comprised a patchwork circle of about 3 miles. I started back for the car, but still felt oddly restless and unsatisfied. I doubled back, negotiating a phalanx of well-appointed baby strollers and headed uphill for the observatory. The park had been a gift to the city back in 1896 by self-made millionaire and silver mining magnate turned philanthropist, Colonel Griffith J. Griffith. A fortune-hunting pioneer of epic dimension, Colonel Griffith left his native Wales as a young boy and came to America, where he taught himself mineralogy and learned the industry of precious metal extraction. Largely from his work developing the silver mines in Chihuahua, Mexico, he quickly built a fortune and a reputation that was testament to America's promise as a gateway to unregulated environmental plunder. Griffith's acclaim as a boundlessly generous city founder suffered an ignominious death when he attempted to murder his wife by shooting her in the eyeball with a pistol. In a trial rivaling the worst Hollywood script, gritty and independently wealthy Mrs. Griffith survived the assault, hired a special prosecutor from Sacramento, and testified in person at her husband's trial. She described not only his murderous intent, but also his state of mind, which could be readily implied from his accusations that Mrs. Griffith had been conspiring with the Pope in a plot to overthrow Teddy Roosevelt. After 2 years in San Quentin, Colonel Griffith emerged to face a scornful public, which, in its collective disdain, ultimately voted to rename Griffith Peak to Mount Hollywood. He died in 1919, several years after giving the city another $100,000 to build an observatory on the uppermost plateau of the park. The city accepted the gift and built the observatory, but denied Griffith's atonement. Lore holds that when he was buried, lines of people formed at his headstone, which to this day is darkened along its edges with stains of urine. But never mind the scandal and the headlines and the rumors, which, even if accurate, have no relevance to my life or remembrance. Here is what is important. 5 times the size of Central Park in Manhattan, Griffith Park spans 4,000 acres of woodland terrain, stretching over chaparral-covered hills, beneath sunlit canopies of oak and walnut and lilac, split by deep rock canyons and seamed with trails that loop and meander and climb to a summit looking down upon the glass and steel of Los Angeles proper. The Griffith Park of my memory was an oasis of genuine green earth bordering a rising sea of smog, violence, celebrated vapidity, illusion, techno-idolatry, and mendacious breakneck profiteering. Colonel Griffith's legacy was, for me at least, a place of natural communion, a welcome respite from all that was Hollywood. When I first moved to Los Angeles, with a suitcase, a useless English literature degree, and a job offer to write for a reputable but overstuffed book review quarterly called the LAQ, I lived in a rundown apartment building in Monterey Park, sandwiched between Alhambra to the north and East Los Angeles to the south, within earshot of Interstate 10, and one stiff breeze away from the EPA Region 9 landfill, baking in the sun on the far side of the Pomona Freeway. It was less of an apartment complex than a go-to housing project run by the County of Los Angeles Parole Board, and the adult film industry. Carpooling sign-up sheets to and from Van Nuys were commonly pinned above the mailboxes. There were daily brawls and screaming fits, and a colorful, screeching assemblage of squad cars in the parking lot on roughly a monthly basis. Cockroaches abounded. Second only to the tiny Rancho Park cubicle where I worked, the Vista Soul Apartments complex was the worst habitat of my life, and emblematic of the hopelessness of my postgraduate options. I very nearly left within 3 weeks to return to Ohio and to take up again with my parents, which, at the age of 21, was as good a measure of desperation as I could have ever conceived. I stayed for 6 months before escaping to a fourplex in Westwood, a fortuitous change of location that coincided with my discovery. One is discovered in Hollywood. There is no resisting or circumnavigating that concept in show business. All that you were or ever have been is merely an inconsequential prelude to discovery, the point at which life is supposed to really begin. Lana Turner was born at the Schwab's lunch counter on Sunset Boulevard. I was born in the home of a bent pipe cleaner of a man named Orrin Twill. Orrin was not a movie producer, and ours was not a typical, you ought to be in the pictures, sort of encounter. He published a trade journal with a small but respectable circulation within investor circles, Second Take, and was devoted to discussion of emergent trends in the American film industry. At the time of our brief acquaintance, Orrin was polishing up a book he had written, synthesizing the economic, cultural, and political forces that, to Orrin's way of thinking, were simultaneously nourishing and co-opting the independent film movement. The LAQ had been provided an advance copy, and I was assigned to work on the review. I remember Orrin's book, though I have forgotten its long analytic title, as a loosely constructed, highly anecdotal work, relying so heavily on interviews with the movers and shakers in the independent film movement that it was more a self-portrait of that movement than anything approaching an objective analysis. The LAQ review of the book made this point rather strongly. And while the review was not published under my name, since I was only an assistant, I felt bad enough that I never quite had the courage to contact Orrin until several years later, after everything had changed. My first and only actual meeting with Orrin was for an afternoon at his modest but clean and precisely furnished home in Culver City. The door opened to reveal a tall, lanky man, completely bald, with an unfortunately long and sallow face that initially reminded me of a central casting butler at some haunted mansion. The sides of his face were drawn, as if by collapse, into the hollows of his mouth, and his chin was an angular prominence that seemed to stretch his skin tightly around his skull. Fortunately, the familiarity of Orrin's voice came immediately to his rescue. I quickly found that he had an inner kindness and smart, lively eyes, and a smile that deconstructed any resemblance to a ghoulish manservant. We sat in his study, lined to capacity with books, and smelling faintly of cedar wood and aging paper, at a desk that was not really large enough to accommodate us both. Over iced tea and, of all things, bits of pickles and cheese, he explained to me the thesis of his work. He spoke in a slow, measured cadence, choosing his words carefully, seeming to weigh them on his tongue before he let them out into the light. When I asked questions, Oren focused those deep-set eyes from beneath the shelf of his brow, regarding me with an intensity far beyond what my query required. As though he was taking some measure of the qualities in me that had coalesced to produce the question. Or as though he was working on his own questions on a vastly different and more personal subject. He painstakingly walked me through the sheaves of research that he had stacked in a cardboard box beneath his computer, interview transcripts mostly, and expounded on some of the personalities that he had encountered in the course of the project. Oren referred to motion picture royalty as personalities, as though he had somehow managed to channel the essence of discarnate celebrity and avoid the distaste or inconvenience of interacting with the whole person. He simultaneously loved and loathed these people. Robert Redford was only one example. Redford, for whom Oren had the greatest admiration and who was to be writing a foreword to the book, was nevertheless an incredibly difficult and unaccommodating personality. Because, as Oren put it, Bob knows what he likes and has his own way of doing things when it comes to business matters. We spent some time discussing Oren's mounting irritation at the lack of even a draft of the promised foreword and agonizing over just how one went about reordering the priorities of someone like Robert Redford without losing the opportunity altogether.
I mean, you tell me, just how many messages does one leave?
As we spoke, Oren's 8-year-old mop-headed daughter, who introduced herself to me from behind her father's leg as Miss Rosalie Twill, sat on the floor coloring quietly in the pages of a large, flat book. Rosalie, dressed in a bright yellow jumper over a pale blue tee, hummed to herself as she worked, the pink flesh of her tongue protruding first here and then there, as if some curious little creature inside of her was eagerly popping out to check on her progress. Every so often, Rosalie would look up from her book, take stock of her surroundings, regard us from across the room, and then, with slow, precise movements, withdraw another assortment of wax crayons from the small wooden box at her side, resubmerging herself into a magical oblivion of her own. I learned that Rosalie's mother, Oren's wife of many years, had died of an aneurysm when Rosalie was barely 4. With a slow, contemplative reverence for the event, Oren offered this information a good 3 hours into my visit, by way of explaining Rosalie's constant presence in the study as we spoke.
She stays pretty close, he said.
And I knew that what he meant was that their closeness and need for each other was fiercely mutual. And I understood that his need for her was still, perhaps increasingly, desperate. Must be tough being a single parent, I said, not mentioning his age.
It's tough enough just being a parent, period. You married?
He asked, skewering a cube of cheese with a toothpick. No, I said. God, no.
You're not from here, are you?
Oren asked. No, about 8 months now.
Thought so. Where's your family?
Ohio, near Columbus.
Are you an only?
No, 2 brothers.
I wish we'd had the time to make another.
he said of the wife who was gone but still very nearby.
I'd like Rosalie to have a brother or a sister.
I looked at the tiny figure tucked into her nook of shelving, busily working on something red. If she knew that we were talking about her, Rosalie did not let on. She's adorable, I said, and meant it.
Yes. One day she'll grow up and break my heart. No doubt about it.
Boys, I said with a sage nod. He gave a laugh and scratched his bald head with his fingertips.
No, not boys. Hollywood. It's how we do things here in California, Tilly. It's how girls here betray their fathers. Boys, I can handle. I'm afraid it's the industry that will take her and have its way. It's already seducing her, and she has no idea. Her aspirations are already aligning the arrow through my heart.
He looked at me wryly, leaning back in his chair. He ate another cube of cheese.
But then, your father must already know a thing or two about that kind of betrayal.
How do you mean?
Well, I don't know.
He moved the back of his right hand in my direction, as if performing some sort of blessing.
You've got that whole classical atavistic pre-Raphaelite enchantment thing going here. You're young and gorgeous and vibrant and living in Los Angeles, playing footsies with the movie industry. You live here, but you're not of here. You're fresh and unspoiled. You're a catch. It's only a matter of time, if you ask me. If your father's heart isn't broken already, it will be soon.
He was joking with me, I knew. And I responded as such. And yet, there was something more serious hidden in his tone that kept me from dismissing his words. Sorry, I said. I'm not the movie star type, and everyone in my family knows it. They would all tell you that I aspire to be difficult and unlikable.
I find that very hard to believe.
Trust me, my father sleeps just fine at night with me in California. Aaron laughed openly.
I'm sure he sleeps like a baby. See, he thinks he's got you safely ensconced in a literary calling. He thinks all his years of fathering have paid off. You're a woman of letters, refined intellect, high moral character. He's sure you've got a book or two in you. You're safe. Of course he sleeps well, but that's not going to last. Not while you're here, anyway. You're gonna wake him up, all right. Poor bastard.
We laughed. I could see that he was prepared to let it go. Inexplicably, I was not. The LAQ is a pretty good review, I said. I could do worse.
Oh, it's a fine review, a fine review. You could do much, much worse. I'm sure your folks are quite proud.
He held up his hands to show he meant no offense. So, what are you saying?
I'm just saying that when I look at you sitting there in all of your raw glory, and I imagine myself 10, 15 years from now with Rosalie out in the world, I can't help but feel a certain kinship with your father, a man I know absolutely nothing about.
A kinship?
Yes,
he said.
A kinship born of a failure to protect our daughters.
From?
Well, from the Beast, of course.
The Beast.
It's that low, guttural sound,
he said, squinting.
That velvet growl you hear out in the tall grasses along the edge of the jungle, calling your name every night when it's dark and quiet, and all your other names are asleep. You'll investigate it sooner or later, and then it will have you like all the others. Like it will have Rosalie.
Maybe you should try writing fiction, Auron. Or maybe lion taming.
There is no taming it, I'm afraid. I write about it. I track its path. I understand it. But it won't be tamed and cannot be resisted. Not when it calls your name.
Hollywood doesn't know my name, Auron.
It knows the name you call yourself,
he said, pointing at me.
It knows what you need.
Which is what, exactly? He shrugged.
Don't know. Vanity, approval, rejection, self-loathing. I don't know you well enough to know that name. But it knows, Tilly. It knows.
Do I look like a Norma Jean to you?
No. But you all, in some way or another, look like Norma Jean to it.
Well, then you really don't know me, I said, because I have absolutely no interest in show business. Seriously, Auron, none. I made a zero with my fingers. None.
If you say so, Tilly. But I'm never wrong about this sort of thing. Have you ever had an agent?
No, never.
Have you ever auditioned for a part in any production?
College? One Ibsen, one Tennessee Williams, one Shakespeare?
Stage doesn't count.
Then, no.
Which Ibsen? A Doll's House?
I shook my head. The Wild Duck. I played Hedwig. Auron grimaced.
That's fun.
That's Ibsen.
Well, your literary beginnings notwithstanding, I'll bet that within 2 years' time, if you continue to live in California, you will be auditioning for the big screen. You'll be Fay Wray to Hollywood's King Kong. The Beast will love you.
No way.
In 2 years' time, I will be listening. What's your father's name?
Hollis Johns.
I will be listening to the Hollis Johns lament. All the way from Ohio, that sad song that we Californian fathers know so well. Hollis's baby girl will have traded everything he gave her, all that intelligence and judgment and self-respect, for a splash in the moral decay at the shallow end of the pool where all the popular kids hang out.
You think that's the path of all actresses?
Of course not. I think that's the fear of all fathers, of all actresses.
But I'm not a shallow person, nor immoral.
Obviously not, and I'm sure you weren't raised to be. That's the betrayal.
I might easily have been insulted, had his tone not been so humorously and genuinely paternal. And had the 30 or so years that separated us been less clear. I told myself that he was speaking more about Rosalie than about me, that he was having the father-daughter chat that Rosalie was too young to understand. That he was venting his concerns about his own inevitable heartbreak. Concerned, not at all, with Hollis Johns of Ohio. So, I took no offense at Oren's words. I insisted again that he was wrong about me, and finally had the good sense to let the point go at that.
Time will tell,
he said with the assistance of his long, bony shoulders.
But if I'm right, Tilly, you must promise me something.
Depends on the promise, I said primly, raising my chin.
Ha! Good girl. If I'm right, you must concede that I discovered you, that I saw the star quality in you before anyone else saw it, before even you saw it.
Agreed.
And if I'm right, you must consent to an interview for my next book.
I laughed and shook his large hand. He began to say something about putting the deal in writing when there was suddenly a high, winsome sigh rising like a stream of helium under intense pressure from the corner of the study. Rosalie rolled over on her back, kicking her bare feet in the air and holding aloft the picture of a scarlet-colored mermaid wearing a blue tiara sitting on a brown rock that jutted from a sea of green.
Isn't she lovely, Daddy?
She's a beauty, sweetheart,
said Oren.
Daddy?
Yes, Rosalie.
Daddy?
Yes, Rosalie.
Daddy, will you take my picture in my hat? And we can put it on my wall next to the other picture of me in my other hat?
Oren looked at me with a comic graveness.
I'm doomed,
he said, and we all laughed. Oren, me, Rosalie, and the beast lying in tall grasses, swishing its tail. I paced the perimeter of the white stone walls that framed Griffith Observatory, panting and clutching my heaving sides. The day had grown warmer with the afternoon, and the climb had more than taken the edge off my restless energy. I half staggered off the trail and out into the parking lot, gleaming hot in the sun. A couple loading children and teenagers out of an SUV paused their commotion and looked at me with open concern. It took a moment for them to recognize plucky Katie Finn. Or perhaps it was the tabloid queen that held their attention. But it came as it always does, with a finger point and whispered exclamation. Cameras were extracted, lens caps pocketed. Zoom lenses silently magnified the pixels on the surface of the beads of sweat streaking my face. I turned back and headed around a bush to the far side of the walkway, slipping out of sight like the wildlife that I had become. When my breath had finally returned, I sat hugging my knees upon the farthest edge of the brown and green mottled escarpment that fanned out like the earthen dress from beneath the observatory, staring out over Los Angeles. From the safety of that plateau, the city looked so harmless, gleaming in its smoggy blue mist, its steel corners and cliffs of glass fracturing the sun into brilliant shards of burnt orange light. I thought of the two meetings, the conversations, that had, to that point, bracketed my career. The first, years earlier with Oren, in his modest study surrounded by his books, regarded from below by little dewy-eyed Rosalie Twill. And the last, only hours ago, in the slick, overstuffed office of Milton Chenoweth, surrounded by glossy black and white photographs, regarded from above by hard-bitten Marion, the Duke, Morrison. The first, a conversation that warned of an impending, traitorous mediocrity. The second, a conversation that seemed to revel in ripening that warning into a promise, nudging mediocrity into its full, inglorious bloom. In the middle of those two conversations lay the city at my feet, a world unto itself.